From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Eric Clapton is one of the greatest guitar players in rock history. On today's Fresh Air, in the first of a two-part interview, Clapton talks about his early romance with the blues. Also today, we meet character actor Vincent Gardenia. He got Oscar nominations as Cher's father in Moonstruck and the manager of a baseball team in Bang the Drum Slowly. And he was a regular on All in the Family. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new album by the British group The Meekons. Their songs take an often cynical look at the music industry itself. And film critic Owen Gleiberman reviews The War of the Roses and She-Devil. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Czech Premier Ladislav Adamec resigned today. Adamec stepped down in the midst of talks with the powerful opposition, which is demanding the communists form an acceptable government or suffer another general strike. Adamec had been expected to name a new government tomorrow that would involve some form of power sharing with the Civic Forum opposition movement. Leaders of Civic Forum appeared on the main evening TV newscast with a list of names they'd given Adamec as possible cabinet members only hours before he resigned. President Gustav Husak has asked Deputy Prime Minister Marian Chalfa to form a new government in the attempt to solve the country's three-week-old political crisis. Researchers at Tulane University say they've developed a vaccine to protect monkeys from an AIDS-like virus. NPR's Richard Harris reports that this advance could help in the development of a vaccine for AIDS.
Rhesus monkeys suffer from a disease quite similar to AIDS. It's caused by a virus very much like the human AIDS virus, and it's also deadly. Reporting in the current issue of Science magazine, scientists at Tulane University say they have developed a vaccine for this monkey disease. Researchers in Massachusetts and California have reported similar results, but this one is the best yet. It protected 8 out of 9 monkeys tested. This provides important clues for developing a human AIDS vaccine, but there are still major obstacles to overcome. Perhaps most important, this vaccine was only tested against one variety of virus, while hundreds of different strains of the human AIDS virus can cause disease. So researchers still aren't sure that a human vaccine is possible. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
Police in Montreal said today the gunman who yesterday killed 14 women and wounded 13 people in a rampage through a building at the University of Montreal carried a 3-page letter that blamed feminists for ruining his life. Jean LaRoche is a reporter with CBC Radio News.
Police were able to confirm that there was a letter. It was a 3-page handwritten note that they found on the gunman. It was signed simply Mark. He had said that he was very unhappy and that women had ruined his life. He had been very unhappy over the past 7 years, and he had listed 15 women's names on this letter. The police say that a lot of them were prominent women in the Montreal area. They're trying to determine right now the connection these people had with the gunman, although they say it's likely the gunman simply got these names out of the newspapers or the media.
The gunman, identified as Marc Lepin, roamed the hallways of the engineering school at the university last night, shooting women with a semi-automatic hunting rifle. A Hispanic policeman in Miami was found guilty of manslaughter today in the deaths of 2 black men, which touched off 2 days of rioting in Miami's inner city. Black leaders say they are pleased with the verdict in the case against William Lozano. This is NPR News. The chairman of the House Armed Services Committee today urged the Bush administration to come up with a new military strategy to take account of Soviet policy changes. Democrat Les Aspin said Defense Secretary Dick Cheney erred in talking publicly about possible budget cuts before discussing his strategy. He warned Cheney that unless he produced the outlines of a new strategy in the next few weeks, it would be impossible to fend off congressional actions to restore individual weapons programs that the Pentagon wants to terminate. The case of Lincoln Savings and Loan Association of California came before a federal judge today in Washington. Charles Keating, Jr., who headed Lincoln, is challenging the government's seizure of his institution. NPR's John Itzde reports.
Keating claims his institution wouldn't have failed if regulators had allowed it to remain open. But regulators say Lincoln may be the most expensive SNL failure of all, costing the taxpayer $2.5 billion. Today in court, lawyers for the Office of Thrift Supervision outlined four land, stock, and tax deals that they say demonstrate Lincoln was being operated in an unsound manner, contrary to federal regulations. They also said the thrift's assets were being siphoned off to benefit its parent company, American Continental Corporation, another Keating operation. The OTS lawyers said one improper tax deal alone essentially gave the parent corporation a $94 million interest-free loan for 3 years at an estimated cost of $20 million to Lincoln. Keating's lawyers say each individual deal can be defended as a sound business decision. I'm John Idstey in Washington.
The Justice Department said today it is doubling the funds spent on prosecuting savings and loan fraud, but Attorney General Dick Thornburgh warned the government probably won't recover a lot of money. Thornburgh and FBI Director William Sessions announced stepped-up thrift prosecutions in 27 cities. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is the guitarist so many rock musicians measure themselves against, one of the first guitar heroes, Eric Clapton. In the early 60s, he played an important part in the British blues scene as a member of the Yardbirds and John Mayall's Bluesbreakers. But with Cream, Blind Faith, and Derek and the Dominoes, he became a rock superstar. For about the last 15 years, he's recorded under his own name. Clapton has a new album called Journeyman, which shows off his blues-inspired playing and singing. Last year, a 4-CD retrospective of Clapton's music was released called Crossroads. I asked Eric Clapton his response to having his whole career represented in a box set.
I found it all very, very encouraging because I realized after it had become quite successful that people were willing to accept what I'd done in my more kind of rougher, beaten-up states as much as they were the sort of polished things, which gave me a lot of encouragement to make the record that I've just made.
Mm-hmm. Now, you started out known as a blues guitar virtuoso, but you later turned more to songs, and you focused at least as much on singing as on playing. Where do you think of yourself as being now in proportion between playing and singing?
I think I'm really a band leader more than anything now. I get my biggest kick from playing with top-caliber musicians and really putting a band sound together, because I don't really think of my guitar playing or my voice as being strong enough, although a lot of people think my guitar playing could be, but I don't think either one of those things is strong enough to just kind of go on its own. You know, I think that really you've got... I'm actually a lot happier to think about making a team effort, and I like to think of it that way. So I actually prefer to think of the whole thing as being a group sound, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me play the track that's the single from your new record. The record's Journeyman, and the single is called Pretending. Do you want to say anything about this before we hear it?
Yeah, I'd like to say that it was written by a great friend of mine called Jerry Williams, I really would like to see him become exposed one day and have his own album. But I love the song, and I've had it around for several years, and I've always wanted to do it.
Let's give it a listen. This is Pretending from Eric Clapton's new album, Journeyman.
Thank you.
an excerpt of Pretending from Eric Clapton's new album, Journeyman. You said that at some point in your career that you got bored with virtuoso musicianship. What was the turning point for you?
Well, I think that might have been a very glib way for me to say that I couldn't get it any better. I actually had reached the end of my capabilities, I think. And a lot of people were taking it further on, so I suppose I had to develop some kind of attitude about it, and it was probably better off for my face to say that I was getting bored, you know.
So after you felt you couldn't take it any further, you wanted to turn to something else?
No, I just realized that technically my potential was probably had come to its end. You know, I'm not that nimble, really. I don't think I can compete on the sort of the fast, furious guitar sort of championship. So I tended to go the other way.
By going the other way, you mean singing more?
Yeah, singing more, or just kind of refining my technique to somewhere where I could simplify it and get more out of it.
I got it.
With doing less, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think a lot of, you know, a lot of today's newer guitar heroes took some of their inspiration from you, and I'm wondering if what you think when you see and hear some of the excesses of of playing and of theatrics now.
Sometimes extreme jealousy, I think. I don't know. Seriously, I think they take it too far. I think it's become a means to an end. You know, it's just like flashy for its own sake a lot of the time, and I think that becomes the focal point of why they do it, and they forget about tone or finesse and some of the more the refinements of it. You know, because I think the easiest way to tell one guitar player from another is when they're playing simply. You know, you can tell the touch, you know.
It took you a while before you started singing regularly on your records. And I was wondering when you decided to start to sing more, if it was difficult to find your voice.
No, I've always sung, you know. Ever since I was a kid, I sing along with records, singing in the, you know, just when I'm kind of moving around, I'm singing in my head and I'm singing out loud too. But it wasn't until I heard myself on tape that I realized how difficult it was to be a proficient singer. That is to say, just basically sing in tune. And then I started to meet people. In fact, only recently I've met some of the members in my band. For instance, have got perfect pitch, and they were born with that. And I realised that there are people who have the gift and others who don't. I don't consider myself to have the gift, and so I have to work extra hard at it, you see. That's the problem with singing for me, is that it's really an uphill climb all the time.
Mm-hmm. Your first inspiration musically was Black Blues by African-American performers. How were you first exposed to it?
When I was a little boy of about 9 years old, I think I heard a couple of records on the radio just being slotted in different variety programs that were by blues musicians from America. One was quite popular, actually, in England. It was called Whooping and Hollering by Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee. And it was an instrumental thing with harmonica and guitar and country blues, really, fast country blues. And then I heard also Big Bill Brunsey, who was quite popular in Europe during the 50s and early 60s, and a fantastic guitar player and a great folk artist, you know. And I was, I don't know why, I was immensely attracted to the sound, I was immensely attracted to the spirit of the music, and I decided to kind of examine it, investigate, and so I became a blues collector, buying export blues records at export shops, and I got finally into people like Muddy Waters and Robert Johnson and all of the country blues players, and that's really where I got all my influences from to begin with.
Did you teach yourself guitar?
Yes, there was no one else interested in the kind of thing I was interested in. It was a very strange, unique phenomena that I was probably one of about four or five people in England, I guess, that at the time that were interested in that particular kind of music. So it was quite lonely, but I was dedicated to it. I loved that music, and I wanted to play it.
What were some of the greatest frustrations of being self-taught?
Not really knowing that, for instance, when you pick up a six-string guitar and I didn't know how to tune it, you know. I mean, just basically didn't know how to tune it. And I refused, you know, I mean, a quite arrogant way to buy the books, you know, buy even those Teach Yourself How to Play Basic Guitar books. So I had to learn how to tune the guitar on my own.
And those books had awful songs.
Well, yeah, that's what, you know, Old Black Joe was the kind of...
Exactly, yeah.
Obligatory kind of songs. I couldn't stand that stuff, and I refused to do it any other way but my own way. And then the next step was, once, if you considered you had got it in tune, was that if you put your fingers on different frets and then tried to make a chord, I was under the impression I was inventing all this stuff, you see, and... In actual fact, it was all being done before, but it was a great. I prefer to think of doing it that way because I felt like I was discovering it all.
Eric Clapton is my guest, and he has a new record called Journeyman. You were learning the blues as a white Englishman, and you were very removed from the lives of the bluesmen whose music you were emulating. Was there an element of romance in your mind to what the blues musician's life was? And did you know anybody who was remotely like the musicians whose work you were listening to and trying to play?
I didn't know anybody at all that I could identify with in that way. But to the first part of your question was that, yes, it was incredibly romantic. I could identify in some aspects in that I came from a very poor country background. And so, that I mean, I was kind of maybe like a white counterpoint of in the English South, you know, except there wasn't a racial situation at all, but we were very poor, and it was like, you know, it was. I imagine it'd be quite similar to somewhere in Mississippi. I don't, maybe not, but I tend to identify with it in that way, and I kind of dreamt of myself being this this lonesome blues singer, you know, at a very early age.
Do you remember the first time you actually performed with a black blues musician?
I think it would have been Sonny Boy Williamson, yeah. And I was already in a professional band called the Yardbirds. I was around 18 years old, and Sonny Boy had just done a tour with the Country Blues Festival through Europe, and he decided that he would like to stay in England and make some money because it was possible then for blues performers like himself to go through Europe and make an incredible amount of money, which is more than they could dream of making in America. And the Yardbirds were somehow linked up with him through the management people to do a tour of England. And I met him and was incredibly scared of him. He was a very, very, a frightening man. I mean, a very nice man, but he had an attitude that he could adopt at any point that was really quite terrifying. Apart from that, musically, he was so inspiring that it was the first taste I had of the real thing, you know.
And what was your reaction to it?
My reaction was very mixed. First of all, I think you get into this. I was very possessive about the blues, and I thought that being that I was one of the only people playing it in England, I tended to think that I owned it around that time in my life. And to meet someone who was real doing it made me feel a little bit ashamed, a little bit possessive, and a little bit resentful about the whole situation, and all mixed up at the same time with overawe, you know, and. I kind of the whole thing sort of seemed very bewildering to me as a phenomenon. You know, it was a bewildering experience.
You know, you use the word playing with someone who was real. It makes me think that you thought of yourself as not real, not.
Well, it was a bit of a kind of phony situation when you think about it. I was English, I was white, and I was dedicated to and playing the blues, or what I thought were the blues. But it was all in an unreal situation, and all derived from records that I bought or listening to the radio, and quite contrived, really. And I deliberately was trying to live what I assume would be a blues man's lifestyle, you know, bumming around with a guitar on my shoulder. And to meet the real thing, who was... And see, Sonny Boy blew a lot of the myth away by being incredibly interested in money and women. And, you know, I had set myself up to think that, you know, a blues man was far, far above these kind of earthly pursuits. You know, I thought that it was much, you know, a blues man would be dedicated to his music and nothing else would matter. And it really wasn't like that at all. You know, it was all down to flashy suits and fast cars and, you know, the stuff that you like in life. And it really kind of shook me up.
So how did it change you?
Well, I guess I started to adopt a lot of those attitudes myself, you know, at a fairly early age. And musically, it meant that I had to get my act together, you know, because I think that what happened with the Arbas was that I was one of the only ones that wanted to. The rest of the guys were, we were all a little bit intimidated by Sonny Boy, but I think the others were more than I was. You know, I was attracted as well as intimidated, and I wanted after that to carry on in that lifestyle, and that the others wanted really to go in a pop music direction.
Let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Eric Clapton, and he has a new record called Journeyman. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Eric Clapton. He has a new album called Journeyman. Let's get back to his days with the Yardbirds. This was their first hit, For Your Love, which came out in 1965.
Dream of me at night.
You were early in your career with the group The Yardbirds and playing a mix of blues and pop, and you left the group after the band really started to get a big hit, which was For Your Love. And
yeah.
My understanding is that you left because you thought that the song was too pop and that the group was getting more commercial and going away from its blues emphasis. I wonder what you think listening back to that record now. I mean, I think it's a really good record, whether it's whether it's blues or not.
Yeah, I think it's a good record. If I hadn't been part of the band, I thought I probably would have liked it then too, but it seemed to me a huge threat at the time. And
I thought because it was taking you away from what you wanted to do?
Well, a very big disappointment, you know, because it was kind of like going out with a girl and then finding out that, you know, that she likes, I don't know, you know, Sly Stallone when you like Robert De Niro. Do you know what I mean? It's like all your tastes suddenly start to diverge, and it was heartbreaking. It was really actually very heartbreaking, and one of the first real big disappointments in my life, because to start out with, the band was very unified in our likes and dislikes, and then I noticed that they became more kind of interested in what the, you know, Freddie and the Dreamers were wearing on stage and things like that. So, I don't know, it just really floored me. And for a while after I left that band, I really considered packing it all in because I didn't think anyone else, you know, cared about it the way I did.
What did you do when you left the band?
I went and stayed with a friend of mine in Oxford. He's a friend of mine who was a pianist first and then became a woodcarver. And he had left the band and he was carving a Tang horse as a method of sort of his way of retaliating against the rest of the band. And we sat up in Oxford and just drank wine and ate pigeon pie for about 3 or 4 months. And then John Mayall got in touch with me and asked me if I'd join his band.
Well, you joined John Mayall with the Blues Breakers, and the emphasis there really was on authenticity and on playing as closely to, you know, the blues records that inspired you as you could get. Was that a satisfying experience?
Yes, it was. I really enjoyed working with John, and I now kind of regret that I left the band so early because we'd only made one record, really, which later on seemed to become a classic, and I think it's a classic record. It would have been nice to have furthered it a bit more, and I know he'll agree with me with that, but I guess I was young and impetuous and I wanted to go my own way. You know, I found my feet so fast with John's band that it seemed like the world was my oyster, you know.
Let's listen to one of the Bluesbreakers records. My guest Eric Clapton sings and plays guitar on this one. This is the Robert Johnson song, Ramblin' on My Mind.
I'm going down to the station, catch that old fast milk train, see. I'm going down to the station, catch that old fast milk train, see. The blues about Miss So-and-so, and the sun got the blues about me.
After the Bluesbreakers with Joan Mayall, you formed Cream with Jack Bruce and Ginger Baker, and you've said that you liked Jack Bruce's irreverence, that you liked him for not trying to be authentic, a bluesman.
Yeah, he came in from another area altogether, and he was one of the first musicians that was, and Ginger too, but Jack, in a much more easily identifiable way, was a rebel, musical rebel. You know, he came from a jazz background, and it was one of the he was like one of the first fusion players I'd ever met who was willing to cross jazz into blues and rock and roll all at the same time. He didn't see that there was a musical boundary, and he was a very intellectual, one of the first musical intellectuals that I met. He was deeply into classical music and modern classical music at that, and I was for quite a while under Jack's spell, because he seemed to me to have, you know, the most unique and avant-garde attitude towards music that I'd ever met.
What did Cream bring out in your playing that you hadn't expressed before?
Freedom, I think. During the time that I was with Cream, I was constantly being urged by Jack and Ginger to kind of throw off all of my inhibitions that I'd spent years honing with the Bluesbreakers, for instance, and my blues rule book was supposed to be going out the window, and it often did. You know, when we played live more than any other time, we would simply just improvise, and it would be very hard for me, more than anyone else, to really get rid of my idea of frameworks and structures. You know, I was really the last one to be able to let go of the things that I'd been using to hold me down up until then.
My guest has been Eric Clapton. I'm Terry Gross, and on the next Fresh Air, part two of our interview, in which Clapton tells about his years with Cream and Blind Faith and talks about the ups and downs of his solo career. Here's Eric Clapton playing guitar with Cream on the Willie Dixon song, Spoonful.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. character actor Vincent Gardenia has been performing since he was 5, but he didn't get his first English-speaking role until he was in his 30s. Coming up, Gardenia talks with us about his formative years performing with his father's Italian-language theater company, and we discuss his recent roles playing Cher's father in Moonstruck and co-starring with Hume Cronin in a new HBO special. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new album from the Mekons. Their musical style embraces punk, country, and reggae, but the unifying theme in their music is a political, often cynical look at the music industry. And film critic Owen Gleiberman reviews two cynical comedies, The War of the Roses and She-Devil. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Prague, Prime Minister Ladislav Adamec resigned unexpectedly today after days of negotiating for a broad-based coalition government with the opposition movement Civic Forum. Sylvia Pacioli reports.
The resignation came less than a day after Adamec appeared on television and threatened to step down because of Civic Forum's increasing demands. The opposition had submitted a list of 7 candidates of their choice. At a press conference this evening, Civic Forum's spokesman said they consider Adamec fully responsible for the current political crisis. State radio reported this evening that the new prime minister is Marian Chalfa, but Civic Forum said he does not have their support. The sudden development seems to have caught Civic Forum by surprise. Spokesmen were unclear whether they would go ahead with their call for a strike on Monday. But the movement scored one major success today when former Communist Party leader Milos Yakis and Prague party boss Miroslav Stepan were kicked out of the party. In Prague, this is Sylvia Pojoli.
On the first day of roundtable talks in East Germany, the government and opposition groups agreed to hold national elections by May 6th. Deidre Berger reports from Berlin.
Initially, most opposition groups wanted to hold off elections until next fall to give them more time to organize. But the country's political situation rapidly deteriorated this week when the Communist Party leadership resigned on Sunday. After several hours of discussion today, the 5 established parties and 7 opposition groups agreed parliamentary elections should be held no later than May 6. East German Prime Minister Hans Modrow tonight warned East Germans from attacking army bases and seizing weapons. There has been no confirmation from the government of reports that several bases have already been attacked. In 4 cities, citizens continue to occupy Secret Service headquarters to prevent the destruction of documents. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Berlin.
Police in Montreal say the gunman who killed 14 women at the University of Montreal late yesterday carried a suicide letter complaining that women had spoiled his life and that he was seeking revenge. The gunman also wounded 9 women and 4 men before killing himself. The Canadian Broadcasting Corporation has reported that police have confirmed the man's identity through his mother and quoted a police spokesman as saying the man's name was Marc Le Pen. Iraq said today that it launched a 48-ton, 3-stage rocket into space 2 days ago. Baghdad television showed what it said was the launch of the 80-foot rocket, showing the countdown and the blastoff. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down almost 16 points to close at 2,720.78 on volume of some 161,480,000 shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. The ever-changing British band The Mekons has a new album called The Mekons Rock and Roll. Rock critic Ken Tucker says it's more than just that.
The Mekons, which formed at the height of punk rock in 1977, have made a career out of rock and roll that criticizes rock and roll. The founding members came from Leeds, a depressed industrial town in northern England, whose other claim to punk fame was the equally political Gang of Four. But where the Gang of Four's critique of rock blossomed and then wilted quite quickly, the Mekons have managed to maintain their running argument with the music in a variety of ways. For one thing, the membership of the band shifts constantly. Group founder John Langford has said that you don't have to be able to make music to be a Mekon, you just have to have something to say.
When I was just 17. Another thing that seems to keep the band fresh is that it doesn't stick with one form of music. The title of this album, The Mekons Rock and Roll, is a little joke, because this band has recorded everything from punk to country music, with side trips to African pop and reggae. One of the reasons this new album is so good is that many of its songs are a combination of these influences. This method reaches a peak on the new album with a wonderful song called Empire of the Senseless.
No one's making any noise now. Shh. We've been waiting for so long. They took away our films and tapes and notebooks. It's okay, we self-censored this song. But these lines are all individuals. There's no such thing as a song. Even the silent are now guilty in me.
Empire of the senseless.
What's your line of questioning, sir?
Empire of the senseless.
I can't intercept a one-word sentence. Invent a war in secrecy. Sliding scenery like a vintage toy. Isn't plastic surgery wonderful? Satellite secret national security.
Empire of the senseless.
Turning journalists into heroes takes some doing.
Empire of the senseless.
Boring Ollie North down in the subway, dealing drugs and guns.
Empire of the senseless.
Turning little liars into heroes. It's what they've always done.
Empire of the senseless.
This song promotes homosexuality. It's in a pretended family relationship with the others on this record. And on the charts and on the jukebox. And in the radio. And in the radio.
Rich, ornery music like this works as a summation of everything the Mekons have been trying to do for the past decade. The Mekons' premise has always been that rock and roll lost its power to shock or surprise or exert much influence on our way of perceiving the world a long time ago. It's a commodity, to use their favorite word, something to be packaged, sold, and bought, still capable of giving pleasure, but essentially inseparable from its function as a profit-making product. Pop music has been this way since the days of Rudy Valley and Bing Crosby, of course. The difference is no one actually sang about this process. The Mekons do, all the time. In one song they sing, "The battles we fought were long and hard, not just to be consumed by rock and roll." On the song Club Mekon, Sally Tim says, "When I was just 17, sex no longer held a mystery. I saw it as a commodity to be bought and sold like rock and roll." And a song called Amnesia exhorts us to, quote, "fight that rock and roll war, truth, justice, and Led Zeppelin." Over and over, rock and roll is used as a metaphor for everything corrupt and exhausted in life, yet the band keeps playing it, keeps, in fact, making brilliant examples of it. Occasionally, this attitude can be strained and arrogant, but more often, it's a useful paradox that enables the band to continue making rock and roll they care about.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for The Village Voice, LA Weekly, and Spin.
We never have to stretch our imaginations. It is our own.
This is Fresh Air. In the hit film Moonstruck, Vincent Gardenia played Cher's loving Italian father, for which he received an Oscar nomination. He also got an Oscar nomination for his part as a baseball team manager in the 1973 film Bang the Drum Slowly. He was featured in the films Where's Papa, Little Murders, and Little Shop of Horrors. On TV, he played Archie Bunker's neighbor, and he received a Tony Award for his supporting part in the Neil Simon play Prisoner of Second Avenue. Gardenia is co-starring with Hume Cronin in an upcoming HBO movie called Age Old Friends. They play best friends who live in a retirement home. The character played by Gardenia is losing his memory. I asked Gardenia if this role forced him to think about getting old.
I've been thinking about this a long time because I've been watching and witnessing the progress of old age. Sometimes it's a progress, sometimes it's a regress. I've seen my father pass away and many of the old-timers as they're getting older. And now as things have gotten modern and much better, I think they've gotten worse because as you get older, you're institutionalized, you're sent to a home, the families are apart. So it's become a longer life, but I think it's become much harder. So I've been thinking about it, not only now, but it's quite a few years that I've been thinking about this. It's not that good.
You know, I think it's usually difficult for older actors to find good parts, but with you, you've become better known in your 60s than you've ever been before.
Yeah, thank God. That's because I think it's that I've done so much work, and when you put it all together, it's like one big, gigantic jigsaw puzzle. One piece went with the other, and one piece went with the other. Until finally, after so many years, you put the piece together. It's, oh, there it is, and that's why I've gotten more recognition as I got older. And the last 4 or 5 years, it's been just tremendous. But I still think we have a few more pieces to fit in there. I hope we can make it.
Let me ask you about one of the recent roles that a lot of people know you for, and that's Moonstruck, in which you played Cher's father. You played an Italian-American, and I was wondering what kind of thought you put behind how to do the kind of Italian-American hand gestures in this. Do you know what I mean? Like how much to put in without it going overboard.
That was a big stretch, you know, playing an Italian.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I think that, for me, I must say, was one of the easiest roles that I've ever played. Not difficult at all. Not that I want to take credit for it. First of all, you know, I am an Italian. I've lived my Italian life all my life. We had a fantastic, wonderful script that the author, who happens to be Irish, but he's in that script, he wrote so Italian that it was unbelievable. A marvelous director by Norman Jewison and a fine company. So that's why I say it was easy for me to portray that man. Without knowing, unconsciously, you do those gestures or that inflation or that infection of the voice, you know? It's just that you've lived that life so long, and I've been with the Italians, Italian families. I always lived at home, and my family, we always spoke Italian. That's my first language.
Mm-hmm. Now, you got an Academy Award nomination for your role in Moonstruck.
Right.
You got your first Academy Award nomination for Bang the Drum Slowly,
yes,
where you played the manager of a baseball team, and the players included Robert De Niro and Michael Moriarty.
Yes.
Would you describe your character and what you liked about playing that role?
Well, you know, very, very funny about that role, or strange. As I said, being an Italian all my life, as a child, I grew up in Brooklyn, and we never went to ball games. I never been to a ball game in my life until 1977, when the Yankees won the World Series in Yankee Stadium. So when I was offered this role, I knew nothing about baseball whatsoever, except, you know, seeing it on television now and then. But I knew nothing about you know, the penalties, the errors. I knew that they were the three strikes and you're out, and, you know, 11 innings or nine innings, whatever it is. So I didn't know much about it. And I had never been to a ball game. So when I met these people, the producer, Maurice Rosenfeld, and the director, John Hancock, I told my agent to tell them that I would not discuss the way I would interpret this role because I work very, very methody, and I don't like to divulge my secrets. Because if they would have asked me something, I wouldn't know what to say. So they accepted that. And when I went on the show, did the movie, in fact, the first day we were out at Central Park, just rehearsing, you know, and the director said, you know, let's all throw the ball. Let's get to know each other. Let's have some fun. He says, Vince, whenever you want to jump in. I said, no, I'm playing the manager. You know, the manager is always on the outside. I figure if I get in this game, I'm going to get hit by a ball or something, you know. And in fact, then when we shot in Yankee Stadium, the first scene that morning, we were all in the dugout, my team, De Niro, Moriarty, and Phil Foster and all. And the director said, you all line up here, put your hands over your heart, and we sing the Star Spangled Banner. And if it's over, everyone goes out to their bases. And Vince, when they're all in their bases, you leave the dugout, go to third base, and speak to the third baseman. I says, gotcha. As he left, I turned to the actor next to me and says, where's third base? And he thought I was kidding. I said, no, I know where it is on television, but yeah, I don't know where it is. He said, well, it's over there. But, you know, he thought I was joking. I said, no, I don't know anything about it. And the only reason I was able to function in that role is because the character that I thought of in that movie was, I thought that the ball team was, they were all my children. It was like a father. So more than a ball game, I treated it as a family, and that sort of worked, I think, you know.
How did you manage to avoid going to a baseball game all those years growing up in Brooklyn?
Well, I wasn't interested in baseball. At that time, I was working with my dad in the Italian Theater. We used to work 6-7 days a week, and we used to tour the 5 boroughs in Brooklyn, the Bronx, New York. Then we'd go out of state. And when I was outside, I rather enjoyed playing stick ball or kicking the can, playing dice, you know, the corner street games. And but I mainly, my friends were at that time, even then, were all the Italian actors. So, you know, they weren't interested in baseball. And we wouldn't listen to baseball on radio because at that time on radio we had Italian programs, Italian soap operas, which when I got to be about 14, 15, I became an Italian radio actor, doing soap operas in Italian. So we were interested in that kind of, those kind of programs, not sports, not games. My father didn't speak English. My mother didn't speak English. They weren't just into sports, you know. That's why I managed to miss the games.
Now, you were actually born in Naples, Italy.
Yes.
You moved with your family to the States, I think, when you were 2 years old. And as you've said, you acted in the Italian theater when you got older. Now, did your father run his own company?
Yes, my father, it was called the Gennaro Gardini Dramatic Company, and it was like the Jewish theater, you know. We had our own company, we were about 20 people, and it was really a 4-hour show, almost 4 hours. We would start with vaudeville, then we'd do a 3-act play, and then close with a commedia dell'arte farce. So we would travel from borough to borough, state to state, and put on the shows. And it was his company, and he used to book the shows, he used to write the shows, he directed the shows. Then as he got older, and I got older myself, I started to take over to book the shows and direct the shows. And, you know, I was participating more and more in the business area and the acting area.
How old were you when you started acting?
I was 5.
That's pretty young.
Yeah, very young.
You know, a lot of kids of immigrant parents resent their parents' old country ways and rebel against them. I guess you never went through a phase like that.
No. Being actors, my father was very, very well liked in this country. I'm talking like Willie Loman now. They really adored my father, so consequently, we were always treated royally by our neighbors, our friends, and the wherever we went. So I never felt that kind of discrimination. So it was, I had a wonderful childhood with my parents. We had actors at our house all the time. There were parties all the time. The wine was flowed freely, you know, from the age of 5 at the table, and the lasagna and the singing and the it was a joyous time. In fact, I had more fun then than now. I miss those days a great deal.
How old were you when you got your first English speaking part?
Oh, how old was I? I was about, I must have been in my 30s. I started off Broadway in The Man with the Golden Arm, and from 56 until now, I must have done, you know, maybe 30 or 40 plays on and off Broadway. I must have done maybe 40 movies, and not counting the TV appearances, you know.
Do you think that your father would have liked to act in English-speaking movies or on the English-speaking stage?
Oh, yes, very much so. My father was a wonderful actor, but not being able to speak the language, he never tried it, and he didn't want to be embarrassed by not speaking well or, you know, not coming off well. Being that he was a major star in the Italian theater, I think he would have loved it, you know.
How come your parents never learned to speak English?
Because they were so successful in the Italian theater. My father was so successful, you know, he did so well. And why leave it when you're doing that well? My father came to this country, and after 4 years, you know, without speaking the language, without a dollar in his pocket, he was able to call, send for my mother and myself, and he bought a one-family home, and he lived very, very good. We lived very well all our lives. Never millionaires, never rich, but always well. So there was no need to go out and venture into something else.
You still live in Brooklyn now?
Oh, yes, I still I've been in this house where I am now for 34 years.
And what keeps you there?
The community, the neighbors, the remembering my family lived there. A lot of wonderful thoughts and a lot of good people. A lot of stores where I shop, and they know me. The mechanic knows me, the doctor knows me, the priest knows me, the neighbor knows me. The garbage people, you know, they take my garbage, they put it back. I'm in good hands with Brooklyn and Allstate.
Well, Vincent Gardenia, thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry.
Actor Vincent Gardenia. He co-stars in the HBO movie Age Old Friends, which airs in December and January. This is Gardenia and Cher sipping champagne at the kitchen table in Moonstruck.
You look tired, Pop.
So what's your news?
I'm getting married.
Again?
Yeah.
You did this once before, it didn't work out.
But the guy died.
And what killed him?
He got hit by a bus.
No, bad luck. Your mother and I were married 52 years. Nobody died. You were married, what, 2 years? Somebody's dead. Don't get married again, Loretta. It don't work out for you. Who's the man?
Johnny Camerari.
Johnny Camerari? He's a big baby. And why isn't he here with you telling me this?
Because he's flying to Sicily. His mother is dying.
More bad luck.
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Noah Adams. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. The coup is mostly over in the Philippines now. There is indeed, though, a tough time ahead for President Corazon Aquino in that country. The premier of Czechoslovakia, Ladislav Adamec, has resigned, saying he was under too much pressure from the opposition, too many demands. The deputy premier has been named to replace him. Also, we'll have some new music from composer and singer and songwriter Lenny Kravitz, and a farewell to songwriter Sammy Fain, who wrote the music for lots of songs that you know, including I'll Be Seeing You. Sammy Fain died yesterday.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Two new dark comedies about love and revenge open in movie theaters this weekend. Critic Owen Gleiberman has a review of She-Devil and The War of the Roses.
Even when he steps behind the camera, you can tell Danny DeVito is one of the shortest men in Hollywood. He directs movies like someone who spent his life working to get your attention. DeVito's first effort, Throw Mama from the Train, was so full of loud acting and go-for-the-throat camera angles, I could barely sit through it. But The War of the Roses is another story. This very dark farce about a marriage that goes to hell has been made in that same high decibel DeVito style. Yet it's also a weirdly honest and perceptive send-up of the way marital affection can gradually turn to hatred. Michael Douglas and Kathleen Turner play the roses. He's a rising young lawyer, and she's a romantic who'll follow him anywhere. They're in love, all right, yet the recipe for disaster is there. You can see it in the subtle ruthlessness behind Douglas's pursuit of the good life, and in Turner's obsessive eagerness to please him. Slowly but surely, their petty differences escalate into full-blown psychological warfare. Then the war turns violent.
When I watch you eat, when I see you asleep, when I look at you lately, I just want to smash your face in.
Come on, smash my face. Come on, you want to smash my face? And...
What's juicy about The War of the Roses is the way it taps the sadistic undercurrents of divorce. This gleefully vicious movie understands that even when the partners in a marriage want to kill each other, their hostility is every bit as intimate as their love. The film is relentless, and its atmosphere of comic violence peaks a little too early. But this isn't your typical case of Hollywood overstatement. Relentlessness is what The War of the Roses is about. Danny DeVito has come up with a real screwball triumph here. A cynical slapstick version of Scenes from a Marriage. As it happens, there's another comedy of vengeance out this week. only this one is a limp disaster. Susan Seidelman's She-Devil, which is based on a celebrated novel by the British author Faye Weldon, tells the story of a rather lopsided romantic triangle. Schlubby housewife Roseanne Barr is married to lecherous accountant Ed Begley Jr. At a cocktail party, the two run into Mary Fisher, played by Meryl Streep, a self-infatuated romance novelist who commences an affair with Begley.
What are you doing?
Oh, Bob, look at it. I just spilled my wine on the famous author, Mary Fisher.
I read all of your books.
That's very nice. Don't.
Ruth, why don't you go get some salt and some Perrier to remove the stain? Hurry, honey, hurry.
Salt and Perrier, a man familiar with a woman's domain. I like that.
No, it's just that my wife's always spilling things. She's a bit clumsy.
That's your wife? It's too bad.
Yeah.
Streep is bound to win praise here for letting her hair down. Yet I think I would have enjoyed her performance more if every campy swoon weren't calculated to make you applaud how unseriously she can take herself. That's true of the entire movie, which plays like a feature-length episode of Love American Style. As always, Seidelman's specialty is turning everything into a coy put-on. There's something smug in that, as though she thought she were above playing a story straight. And what a story! Barr's revenge scheme, which involves an entire army of sister housewives, is so contrived and complicated you have to keep reminding yourself what it is exactly she's up to. A comedy like The War of the Roses gives us the thrill of revenge and then shows us the price. In She-Devil, all you get is the mechanics.
Owen Gleiberman is a Boston-based writer and critic. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, Thad Kirk, Dan Lachlan, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by grants from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, part two of our interview with rock guitar virtuoso and singer Eric Clapton. And we talk with South African composer and pianist Abdullah Ibrahim. He lives in self-exile in the U.S. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.